I also will conquer myself. I have seen one man only, thought Siddhartha, before whom I must lower my eyes. I will never lower my eyes before any other man. No other teachings will attract me, since this man's teachings have not done so. The Buddha has robbed me, thought Siddhartha. He has robbed me, yet he has given me something of greater value. He has robbed me of my friend, who believed in me and who now believes in him. He was my shadow and is now Gotama's shadow. But he has given to me Siddhartha, myself. Awakening. As Siddhartha left the grove in which the Buddha, the Perfect One, remained, in which Govinda remained, he felt that he had also left his former life behind him in the grove. As he slowly went on his way, his head was full of his thoughts. He reflected deeply until this feeling completely overwhelmed him, and he reached a point where he recognized causes. For to recognize causes, it seemed to him, is to think. And through thought alone, feelings become knowledge and are not lost, but become real and begin to mature. Siddhartha reflected deeply as he went on his way. He realized that he was no longer a youth, he was now a man. He realized that something had left him, like the old skin that a snake sheds. Something was no longer in him, something that had accompanied him right through his youth and was part of him. This was the desire to have teachers and to listen to their teachings. He had left the last teacher he had met, even he, the greatest and wisest teacher, the holiest, the Buddha. He had to leave him. He could not accept his teachings. Slowly the thinker went on his way and asked himself, "What is it that you want to learn from teachings and teachers? And although they taught you much, what was it they could not teach you?" And he thought, "It was the self, the character and nature of which I wished to learn. I wanted to rid myself of the self, to conquer it, but I could not conquer it. I could only deceive it, could only fly from it, could only hide from it. Truly nothing in the world has occupied my thoughts as much as the self, this riddle that I live, that I am one and am separated and different from everybody else, that I am Siddhartha. And about nothing in the world do I know less than about myself, about Siddhartha." The thinker, slowly going on his way, suddenly stood still, gripped by this thought, and another thought immediately arose from this one. It was, "The reason why I do not know anything about myself, the reason why Siddhartha has remained alien and unknown to myself, is due to one thing, to one single thing. I was afraid of myself. I was fleeing from myself. I was seeking Brahman, Atman. I wished to destroy myself, to get away from myself, in order to find in the unknown innermost the nucleus of all things, Atman, life, the divine, the absolute. But by doing so, I lost myself on the way." Siddhartha looked up and around him. A smile crept over his face, and a strong feeling of awakening from a long dream spread right through his being. Immediately he walked on again, quickly, like a man who knows what he has to do. "Yes," he thought, breathing deeply, "I will no longer try to escape from Siddhartha. I will no longer devote my thoughts to Atman and the sorrows of the world. I will no longer mutilate and destroy myself in order to find a secret behind the ruins. I will no longer study Yoga Veda, Atharva Veda, or asceticism, or any other teachings. I will learn from myself, be my own pupil. I will learn from myself the secret of Siddhartha." He looked around him as if seeing the world for the first time. The world was beautiful, strange, and mysterious. Here was blue, here was yellow.
It was green, sky and river, woods and mountains, all beautiful, all mysterious and enchanting. And in the midst of it, he, Siddhartha, the awakened one, on the way to himself. All this yellow and blue, river and wood, passed for the first time across Siddhartha's eyes. It was no longer the magic of Mara. It was no more the veil of Maya. It was no longer meaningless and the chance diversities of the appearances of the world, despised by deep-thinking Brahmins who scorned diversity, who sought unity. River was river, and if the one and divine in Siddhartha secretly lived in blue and river, if it was just the divine art and intention that there should be yellow and blue, there sky and wood, and here Siddhartha. Meaning and reality were not hidden somewhere behind things. They were in them, in all of them. How deaf and stupid I have been, he thought, walking on quickly. When anyone reads anything which he wishes to study, he does not despise the letters and punctuation marks and call them illusions, chance, and worthless shells, but he reads them. He studies them and loves them, letter by letter. But I, who wished to read the book of the world and the book of my own nature, did presume to despise the letters and signs. I called the world of appearances illusion. I called my eyes and tongue chance. Now it is over. I have awakened. I have indeed awakened and have only been born today. But as these thoughts passed through Siddhartha's mind, he suddenly stood still, as if a snake lay in his path. Then, suddenly, this also was clear to him. He who was in fact like one who had awakened or was newly born must begin his life completely afresh. When he left the Jetavana grove that morning, the grove of the illustrious one, already awakened, already on the way to himself, it was his intention, and it seemed the natural course for him, after the years of his asceticism, to return to his home and his father. Now, however, in that moment as he stood still as if a snake lay in his path, this thought also came to him. I am no longer what I was. I am no longer an ascetic, no longer a priest, no longer a Brahmin. What then shall I do at home with my father? Study? Offer sacrifices? Practice meditation? All this is over for me now. Siddhartha stood still, and for a moment an icy chill stood over him. He shivered inwardly like a small animal, like a bird or a hare, when he realized how alone he was. He had been homeless for years and had not felt like this. Now he did feel it. Previously, when in deepest meditation, he was still his father's son. He was a Brahmin of high standing, a religious man. Now he was only Siddhartha, the awakened. Otherwise, nothing else. He breathed in deeply, and for a moment he shuddered. Nobody was so alone as he. He was no nobleman belonging to any aristocracy, no artisan belonging to any guild and finding refuge in it, sharing its life and language. He was no Brahmin sharing the life of the Brahmins, no ascetic belonging to the Shramanas. Even the most secluded hermit in the woods was not one and alone. He also belonged to a class of people. Govinda had become a monk, and thousands of monks were his brothers, wore the same gown, shared his beliefs, and spoke his language. But he, Siddhartha, where did he belong? Whose life would he share? Whose language would he speak? At that moment, when the world around him melted away, when he stood alone like a star in the heavens, he was overwhelmed by a feeling of icy despair, but he was more firmly himself than ever. That was the last shudder of his awakening, the last pains of birth. Immediately he moved on again and began to walk quickly and impatiently, no longer homewards, no longer to his father, no longer looking backwards. Part 2. Kamala. Siddhartha learned something new on every step of his path, for the world was transformed and he was enthralled. He saw the sun rise over forest and mountains and set over the distant palm shore. At night he saw the stars in the heavens and the sickle-shaped moon floating like a boat in the blue. He saw trees, stars, animals, clouds, rainbows, rocks, weeds, flowers, brook and river, the sparkle of dew on bushes in the morning, distant high mountains, blue and pale. Birds sang, bees hummed, the wind blew gently across the rice fields. All this, colored and in a thousand different forms, had always been there. The sun and the moon had always shone. The rivers had always flowed and the bees had hummed. But in previous times all this had been nothing to Siddhartha but a fleeting and elusive veil before his eyes, regarded with distrust, condemned to be disregarded and ostracized from the thoughts, because it was not reality, because reality lay on the other side of the visible. But now his eyes lingered on this side. He saw and recognized the visible, and he sought his place in this world. He did not seek reality. His goal was not on any other side. The world was beautiful when looked at in this way, without any seeking, so simple, so childlike. The moon and the stars were beautiful, the brook, the shore, the forest and rock, the goat and the golden beetle, the flower and butterfly were beautiful. It was beautiful and pleasant to go through the world like that, so childlike, so awakened, so concerned with the immediate, without any distrust. Elsewhere the sun burned fiercely. Elsewhere there was cool in the forest shade. Elsewhere there were pumpkins and bananas. The days and nights were short. Every hour passed quickly like a sail on the sea, beneath the sail of a ship of treasures, full of joy. Siddhartha saw a group of monkeys in the depths of the forest, moving about high in the branches, and heard their wild, eager cries. Siddhartha saw a ram follow a sheep and mate. In a lake of rushes he saw the pike making chase in evening hunger. Swarms of young fishes, fluttering and glistening, moved anxiously away from it. Strength and desire were reflected in the swiftly moving whirls of water formed by the raging pursuer. All this had always been, and he had never seen it. He was never present. Now he was present and belonged to it. Through his eyes he saw light and shadows. Through his mind he was aware of moon and stars. On the way, Siddhartha remembered all that he had experienced in the garden of Jetavana, the teachings he had heard there from the holy Buddha, the parting from Govinda, and the conversation with the illustrious one. He remembered each word that he had said to the illustrious one, and he was astonished that he had said things which he did not then really know. What he had said to the Buddha, that the Buddha's wisdom and secret was not teachable, that it was inexpressible and incommunicable, and which he had once experienced in an hour of enlightenment, was just what he had now set off to experience, what he was now beginning to experience. He must gain experience himself. He had known for a long time that his self was Atman, of the same eternal nature as Brahman. But he had never really found his self, because he had wanted to trap it in the net of thoughts. The body was certainly not the self, nor the play of senses, nor thought, nor understanding, nor acquired wisdom or art with which to draw conclusions and from already existing thoughts to spin new thoughts. No, this world of thought was still on this side, and it led to no goal when one destroyed the senses of the incidental self, but fed it with thoughts and erudition. Both thought and the senses were fine things. Behind both of them lay hidden the last meaning. It was worthwhile listening to them both, to play with both, neither to despise nor overrate either of them, but to listen intently to both voices. He would only strive after whatever the inward voice commanded him, not tarry anywhere but where the voice advised him. Why did Gotama once sit down beneath the bow tree in his greatest hour when he received enlightenment? He had heard a voice in his own heart which commanded him to seek rest under this tree. And he had not taken recourse to mortification of the flesh, sacrifices, bathings or prayers, eating or drinking, sleeping or dreaming. He had listened to the voice. To obey no other external command, only the voice, to be prepared. That was good, that was necessary. Nothing else was necessary. During the night, as he slept in a ferryman's straw hut, Siddhartha had a dream. He dreamt that Govinda stood before him in the yellow robe of the ascetic. Govinda looked sad and asked him, "Why did you leave me?" Thereupon he embraced Govinda, put his arm round him, and as he drew him to his breast and kissed him, he was Govinda no longer, but a woman. And out of the woman's gown emerged a full breast, and Siddhartha lay there and drank. Sweet and strong tasted the milk from this breast. It tasted of woman and man, of sun and forest, of animal and flower, of every fruit, of every pleasure. It was intoxicating. When Siddhartha awoke, the pale river shimmered past the door of the hut, and in the forest the cry of an owl rang out deep and clear. As the day began, Siddhartha asked his host, the ferryman, to take him across the river. The ferryman took him across on his bamboo raft. The broad sheet of water glimmered pink in the light of the morning. "It is a beautiful river," he said to his companion. "Yes," said the ferryman, "it is a very beautiful river. I love it above everything. I have often listened to it, gazed at it, and I have always learned something from it. One can learn much from a river." "Thank you, good man," said Siddhartha as he landed on the other side. "I am afraid I have no gift to give you, nor any payment. I am homeless, a Brahmin's son, and a Shramana." "I could see that," said the ferryman. "And I did not expect any payment or gift from you. You will give it to me some other time." "Do you think so?" said Siddhartha merrily. "Certainly. I have learned that from the river, too. Everything comes back. You too, Shamana. You will come back. Now farewell. May your friendship be my payment. May you think of me when you sacrifice to the gods." Smiling, they parted from each other. Siddhartha was pleased at the ferryman's friendliness. "He is like Govinda," he thought, smiling. "All whom I meet on the way are like Govinda. All are grateful, although they themselves deserve thanks. All are subservient, all wish to be my friend, to obey and to think little. People are children." At midday he passed through a village. Children danced about in the lane in front of the clay huts. They played with pumpkin stones and mussels. They shouted and wrestled with each other, but ran away timidly when the strange Shramana appeared. At the end of the village, the path went alongside a brook, and at the edge of the brook a young woman was kneeling and washing clothes. When Siddhartha greeted her, she raised her head and looked at him with a smile, so that he could see the whites of her eyes shining. He called across a benediction, as is customary among travelers, and asked how far the road still was to the large town. Thereupon she stood up and came towards him, her moist lips gleaming attractively in her young face. She exchanged light remarks with him, asked him if he had yet eaten, and whether it was true that the Shramanas slept alone in the forest at night and were not allowed to have any women with them. She then placed her left foot on his right and made a gesture, such as a woman makes when she invites a man to that kind of enjoyment of love which the holy book calls ascending the tree. Siddhartha felt his blood kindle, and as he recognized his dream again at that moment, he stooped a little towards the woman and kissed the brown tip of her breast. Looking up, he saw her face smiling, full of desire, and her half-closed eyes pleading with longing. Siddhartha also felt a longing and the stir of sex in him, but as he had never yet touched a woman, he hesitated a moment, although his hands were ready to seize her. At that moment he heard his inward voice, and the voice said, "No." Then all the magic disappeared from the young woman's smiling face. He saw nothing but the ardent glance of a passionate young woman. Gently he stroked her cheek and quickly disappeared from the disappointed woman into the bamboo wood. Before evening of that day he reached a large town, and he was glad, because he had a desire to be with people. He had lived in the woods for a long time, and the ferryman's straw hut, in which he had slept the previous night, was the first roof he had had over him for a long time. Outside the town, by a beautiful, unfenced grove, the wanderer met a small train of men and women's servants loaded with baskets. In the middle, in an ornamented sedan chair carried by four people, sat a woman, the mistress, on red cushions beneath a colored awning. Siddhartha stood still at the entrance to the grove and watched the procession, the men servants, the maids, and the baskets. He looked at the sedan chair and the lady in it. Beneath heaped-up black hair, he saw a bright, very sweet, very clever face. A bright red mouth like a freshly cut fig, artful eyebrows painted in a high arch, dark eyes, clever and observant, and a clear, slender neck above her green and gold gown. The woman's hands were firm and smooth, long and slender, with broad gold bangles on her wrists. Siddhartha saw how beautiful she was, and his heart rejoiced. He bowed low as the sedan chair passed close by him, and raising himself again, gazed at the bright, fair face, and for a moment into the clever, arched eyes, and inhaled the fragrance of a perfume which he did not recognize. For a moment the beautiful woman nodded and smiled, then disappeared into the grove, followed by her servants. "And so," thought Siddhartha, "I enter this town under a lucky star." He felt the urge to enter the grove immediately, but he thought it over, for it had just occurred to him how the men servants and maids had looked at him at the entrance so scornfully, so distrustfully, so dismissing in their glance. "I am still a Shramana," he thought, "still an ascetic and a beggar. I cannot remain one. I cannot enter the grove like this." And he laughed. He inquired from the first people that he met about the grove and the woman's name, and learned that it was the grove of Kamala, the well-known courtesan, and that besides the grove she owned a house in the town. Then he entered the town. He had only one goal. Pursuing it, he surveyed the town, wandered about it, the maze of streets, stood still in places, and rested on the stone steps to the river. Towards evening he made friends with a barber's assistant, whom he had seen working in the shade of an arch. He found him again at prayer in the temple of Vishnu, where he related to him stories about Vishnu and Lakshmi. During the night he slept among the boats on the river, and early in the morning, before the first customers arrived in the shop, he had his beard shaved off by the barber's assistant. He also had his hair combed and rubbed with fine oil. Then he went to bathe in the river. When the beautiful Kamala was approaching her grove late in the afternoon in her sedan chair, Siddhartha was at the entrance. He bowed and received the courtesan's greeting. He beckoned the servant who was last in the procession and asked him to announce to his mistress that a young Brahmin desired to speak to her. After a time the servant returned, asked Siddhartha to follow him, conducted him silently into a pavilion where Kamala lay on a couch, and left him. "Did you not stand outside yesterday and greet me?" asked Kamala. "Yes, indeed, I saw you yesterday and greeted you. But did you not have a beard and long hair yesterday, and dust in your hair? You have observed well. You have seen everything. You have seen Siddhartha, the Brahmin's son, who left his home in order to become a Shramana, and who was a Shramana for 3 years. Now, however, I have left that path and have come to this town, and the first person I met before I reached the town was you. I have come here to tell you, O Kamala, that you are the first woman to whom Siddhartha has spoken without lowered eyes. Never again will I lower my eyes when I meet a beautiful woman." Kamala smiled, played with her fan made of peacock's feathers, and asked, "Is that all that Siddhartha has come to tell me?" "I have come to tell you this, and to thank you because you are so beautiful. And if it does not displease you, Kamala, I would like to ask you to be my friend and teacher, for I do not know anything of the art of which you are mistress." Thereupon Kamala laughed aloud. "It has never been my experience that a Shramana from the woods should come to me and desire to learn from me. Never has a Shramana with long hair and an old torn loincloth come to me. Many young men come to me, including Brahmin's sons, but they come to me in fine clothes, in fine shoes. There is scent in their hair and money in their purses. That is how these young men come to me, O Shramana." Siddhartha said, "I am already beginning to learn from you. I already learned something yesterday. Already I have got rid of my beard. I have combed and oiled my hair. There is not much more that is lacking, most excellent lady. Fine clothes, fine shoes, and money in my purse. Siddhartha has undertaken to achieve more difficult things than these trifles, and has attained them. Why should I not attain what I decided to undertake yesterday, to be your friend, and to learn the pleasures of love from you? You will find me an apt pupil, Kamala. I have learned more difficult things than what you have to teach me." "So Siddhartha is not good enough for you as he is, with oil in his hair, but without clothes, without shoes, and without money?" Kamala laughed and said, "No, he is not yet good enough for me. He must have clothes, fine clothes, and shoes, fine shoes, and plenty of money in his purse, and presents for Kamala. Do you know now, Shramana from the woods? Do you understand?" "I understand very well," cried Siddhartha. "How could I fail to understand when it comes from such a mouth? Your mouth is like a freshly cut fig, Kamala. My lips are also red and fresh, and will fit yours very well, you will see. But tell me, fair Kamala, are you not at all afraid of the Shramana from the forest who has come to learn about love?" "Why should I be afraid of a Shramana, a stupid Shramana from the forest who comes from the jackals and does not know anything about women?" "Oh, the Shramana is strong and afraid of nothing. He could force you, fair maiden. He could rob you. He could hurt you." "No, Shramana, I am not afraid. Has a Shramana or a Brahmin ever feared that someone could come and strike him and rob him of his knowledge, of his piety, of his power for depth of thought? No, because they belong to himself, and he can only give of them what he wishes, and if he wishes. That is exactly how it is with Kamala and with the pleasures of love. Fair and red are Kamala's lips, but try to kiss them against Kamala's will, and not one drop of sweetness will be obtained from them, although they know well how to give sweetness. You are an apt pupil, Siddhartha. So learn also this. One can beg, buy, be presented with, and find love in the streets, but it can never be stolen. You have misunderstood. Yes, it would be a pity if a fine young man like you misunderstood. Siddhartha bowed and smiled. You are right, Kamala. It would be a pity. It would be a very great pity. No, no drops of sweetness must be lost from your lips, nor from mine. So Siddhartha will come again when he has what he is lacking. Clothes, shoes, money. But tell me, fair Kamala, can you not give me a little advice? Advice? Why not? Who would not willingly give advice to a poor, ignorant Shramana who comes from the jackals in the forest? Dear Kamala, where can I go in order to obtain these three things as quickly as possible? My friend, many people want to know that. You must do what you have learned and obtain money, clothes, and shoes for it. A poor man cannot obtain money otherwise. I can think, I can wait, I can fast. Nothing else? Nothing. Oh, yes, I can compose poetry. Will you give me a kiss for a poem? I will do so if your poem pleases me. What is it called? After thinking a moment, Siddhartha recited this verse. Into her grove went the fair Kamala. At the entrance to the grove stood the brown Shramana. As he saw the lotus flower, deeply he bowed, smiling, acknowledged Kamala. Better, thought the young Shramana, to make sacrifices to the fair Kamala than to offer sacrifices to the gods. Kamala clapped her hands loudly so that the gold bangles tinkled. Your poetry is very good, brown Shramana. And truly there is nothing to lose if I give you a kiss for it. She drew him to her with her eyes. He put his face against hers, placed his lips against hers, which were like a freshly cut fig. Kamala kissed him deeply, and to Siddhartha's great astonishment, he felt how much she taught him, how clever she was, how she mastered him, repulsed him, lured him. And how, after this long kiss, a long series of other kisses, all different, awaited him. He stood still, breathing deeply. At that moment he was like a child, astonished at the fullness of knowledge and learning which unfolded itself before his eyes. "Your poetry is very good," said Kamala. "If I were rich, I would give you money for it. But it will be hard for you to earn as much money as you want with poetry. You will need much money if you want to be Kamala's friend." "How you can kiss Kamala," stammered Siddhartha. "Yes, indeed. That is why I am not lacking in clothes, shoes, bangles, and all sorts of pretty things. But what are you going to do? Cannot you do anything else besides think, fast, and compose poetry?" "I also know the sacrificial songs," said Siddhartha, "but I will not sing them any more. I also know incantations, but I will not pronounce them any more. I have read the scriptures." "Wait," interrupted Kamala. "You can read and write?" "Certainly I can. Many people can do that." "Not most people. I cannot." "It is very good that you know how to read and write, very good. You might even need the incantations." At that moment a servant entered and whispered something in his mistress's ear. "I have a visitor," said Kamala. "Hurry and disappear, Siddhartha. Nobody must see you here. I will see you again tomorrow." However, she ordered the servant to give the holy Brahmin a white gown. Without quite knowing what was happening, Siddhartha was led away by the servant, conducted by a circuitous route to a garden house, presented with a gown, led into the thicket, and expressly instructed to leave the grove unseen as quickly as possible. Contentedly he did what he was told. Accustomed to the forest, he made his way silently out of the grove and over the hedge. Contentedly he returned to the town, carrying his rolled-up gown under his arm. He stood at the door of an inn where travelers met, silently begged for food, and silently accepted a piece of rice cake. Perhaps tomorrow, he thought, I will not need to beg for food. He was suddenly overwhelmed with a feeling of pride. He was a Shramana no longer. It was no longer fitting that he should beg. He gave the rice cake to a dog and remained without food. The life that is lived here is simple, thought Siddhartha. It has no difficulties. Everything was difficult, irksome, and finally hopeless when I was a Shramana. Now everything is easy as the instruction in kissing which Kamala gives. I require clothes and money, that is all. These are easy goals, which do not disturb one's sleep. He had long since inquired about Kamala's townhouse and called there the next day. Things are going well, she called across to him. Kamaswamy expects you to call on him. He is the richest merchant in town. If you please him, he will take you into his service. Be clever, brown Shramana. I had your name mentioned to him through others. Be friendly towards him. He is very powerful, but do not be too modest. I do not want you to be his servant, but his equal. Otherwise I shall not be pleased with you. Kamaswamy is beginning to grow old and indolent. If you please him, he will place great confidence in you. Siddhartha thanked her and laughed, and when she learned that he had not eaten that day nor the previous day, she ordered bread and fruit to be brought to him and attended him. You have been lucky, she said to him on parting. One door after the other is being opened to you. How does that come about? Have you a charm? Siddhartha said, Yesterday I told you I knew how to think, to wait, and to fast, but you did not consider these useful. But you will see that they are very useful, Kamala. You will see that the stupid Shramanas in the forest learn and know many useful things. The day before yesterday I was still an unkempt beggar. Yesterday I already kissed Kamala, and soon I will be a merchant and have money and all those things which you value. Quite, she agreed. But how would you have fared without me? Where would you be if Kamala did not help you? My dear Kamala, said Siddhartha, when I came to you in your grove, I made the first step. It was my intention to learn about love from the most beautiful woman. From the moment I made that resolution, I also knew that I would execute it. I knew that you would help me. I knew it from your first glance at the entrance to the grove. And if I had not wanted? But you did want. Listen, Kamala. When you throw a stone into the water, it finds the quickest way to the bottom of the water. It is the same when Siddhartha has an aim, a goal. Siddhartha does nothing. He waits, he thinks, he fasts. But he goes through the affairs of the world like the stone through the water, without doing anything. Without bestirring himself, he is drawn and lets himself fall. He is drawn by his goal, for he does not allow anything to enter his mind which opposes his goal. That is what Siddhartha learned from the Shramanas. It is what fools call magic, and what they think is caused by demons. Nothing is caused by demons. There are no demons. Everyone can perform magic. Everyone can reach his goal if he can think, wait, and fast. Kamala listened to him. She loved his voice. She loved the look in his eyes. "Perhaps it is as you say, my friend," she said softly. "And perhaps it is also because Siddhartha is a handsome man, because his glance pleases women, that he is so lucky." Siddhartha kissed her and said goodbye. "May it be so, my teacher. May my glance always please you. May good fortune always come to me from you."
Amongst the People. Siddhartha went to see Kamaswami, the merchant, and was shown into a rich house. Servants conducted him across costly carpets to a room where he waited for the master of the house. Kamaswami came in, a supple, lively man with graying hair, with clever, prudent eyes and a sensual mouth. Master and visitor greeted each other in a friendly manner. "I have been told," the merchant began, "that you are a Brahmin, a learned man, but that you seek service with a merchant. Are you then in need, Brahmin, that you seek service?" "No," replied Siddhartha, "I am not in need, and I have never been in need. I have come from the Shramanas, with whom I lived a long time." "If you come from the Shramanas, how is it that you are not in need? Are not all the Shramanas completely without possessions?" "I possess nothing," said Siddhartha, "if that is what you mean. I am certainly without possessions, but of my own free will, so I am not in need." "But how will you live if you are without possessions?" "I have never thought about it, sir. I have been without possessions for nearly 3 years, and I have never thought on what I should live." "So you have lived on the possessions of others?" "Apparently. The merchant also lives on the possessions of others." "Well spoken. But he does not take from others for nothing. He gives his goods in exchange." "That seems to be the way of things. Everyone takes, everyone gives. Life is like that." "Ah, but if you are without possessions, how can you give?" "Everyone gives what he has. The soldier gives strength, the merchant goods, the teacher instruction, the farmer rice, the fisherman fish." "Very well. And what can you give? What have you learned that you can give?" "I can think. I can wait. I can fast." "Is that all?" "I think that is all." "And of what use are they? For example, fasting, what good is that?" "It is of great value, sir. If a man has nothing to eat, fasting is the most intelligent thing he can do." "If, for instance, Siddhartha had not learned to fast, he would have had to seek some kind of work today, either with you or elsewhere, for hunger would have driven him. But as it is, Siddhartha can wait calmly. He is not impatient, he is not in need. He can ward off hunger for a long time and laugh at it. Therefore fasting is useful, sir." "You are right, Shramana. Wait a moment." Kamaswami went out and returned with a roll which he handed to his guest and inquired, "Can you read this?" Siddhartha looked at the roll, on which a sales agreement was written, and began to read the contents. "Excellent," said Kamaswami. "And will you write something for me on this sheet?" He gave him a sheet and pen, and Siddhartha wrote something and returned the sheet. Kamaswami read, "Writing is good, thinking is better. Cleverness is good, patience is better." "You write very well," the merchant praised him. "We shall still have plenty to discuss. But today I invite you to be my guest and to live in my house." Siddhartha thanked him and accepted. He now lived in the merchant's house. Clothes and shoes were brought to him, and a servant prepared him a bath daily. Splendid meals were served twice a day, but Siddhartha only ate once a day, and neither ate meat nor drank wine.
Kamaswami talked to him about his business, showed him goods and warehouses and accounts. Siddhartha learned many new things. He heard much and said little. And remembering Kamala's words, he was never servile to the merchant, but compelled him to treat him as an equal, and even more than his equal. Kamaswami conducted his business with care and often with passion, but Siddhartha regarded it all as a game, the rules of which he endeavored to learn well, but which did not stir his heart. He was not long in Kamaswami's house when he was already taking a part in his master's business. Daily, however, at the hour she invited him, he visited the beautiful Kamala, in handsome clothes, in fine shoes, and soon he also brought her presents. He learned many things from her wise red lips. Her smooth, gentle hand taught him many things. He, who was still a boy as regards love and was inclined to plunge to the depths of it blindly and insatiably, was taught by her that one cannot have pleasure without giving it, and that every gesture, every caress, every touch, every glance, every single part of the body has its secret, which can give pleasure to one who can understand. She taught him that lovers should not separate from each other after making love without admiring each other, without being conquered as well as conquering, so that no feeling of satiation or desolation arises, nor the horrid feeling of misusing or having been misused. He spent wonderful hours with the clever, beautiful courtesan and became her pupil, her lover, her friend. Here with Kamala lay the value and meaning of his present life, not in Kamaswami's business. The merchant passed on to him the writing of important letters and orders, and grew accustomed to conferring with him about all important affairs. He soon saw that Siddhartha understood little about rice and wool, shipping and trade, but that he had a happy knack, and surpassed the merchant in calmness and equanimity, and in the art of listening and making a good impression on strange people. "This Brahmin," he said to a friend, "is no real merchant and will never be one. He is never absorbed in the business. But he has the secret of those people to whom success comes by itself, whether it is due to being born under a lucky star, or whether it is magic, or whether he has learned it from the Shramanas. He always seems to be playing at business. It never makes much impression on him. It never masters him. He never fears failure. He is never worried about a loss." The friend advised the merchant, "Give him a third of the profits of the business which he conducts for you, but let him share the same proportion of losses if they arise. He will thus become more enthusiastic." Kamaswami followed his advice, but Siddhartha was still little concerned about it. If he made a profit, he accepted it calmly. If he suffered a loss, he laughed and said, "Oh, well, this transaction has gone badly." He did, in fact, seem indifferent about business. Once he traveled to a village in order to buy a large rice harvest. When he arrived there, the rice was already sold to another merchant. However, Siddhartha remained in that village several days, entertained the farmers, gave money to the children, attended a wedding, and returned from the journey completely satisfied. Kamaswami reproached him for not returning immediately, for wasting time and money. Siddhartha replied, "Do not scold, my dear friend. Nothing was ever achieved by scolding. If a loss has been sustained, I will bear the loss. I am very satisfied with this journey. I have become acquainted with many people. I have become friendly with a Brahmin. Children have sat on my knee. Farmers have showed me their fields. Nobody took me for a merchant." "That is all very fine," admitted Kamaswami reluctantly. "But you are, in fact, a merchant. Or were you only traveling for your pleasure?"
"Certainly I traveled for my pleasure," laughed Siddhartha. "Why not?
I have become acquainted with people and new districts. I have enjoyed friendship and confidence. Now, if I had been Kamaswami, I should have departed immediately, feeling very annoyed when I saw I was unable to make a purchase, and time and money would indeed have been lost. But I spent a number of good days, learned much, had much pleasure, and did not hurt either myself or others through annoyance or hastiness. If I ever go there again, perhaps to buy a later harvest, or for some other purpose, friendly people will receive me, and I will be glad that I did not previously display hastiness and displeasure. Anyway, let it rest, my friend, and do not hurt yourself by scolding. If the day comes when you think, this Siddhartha is doing me harm, just say one word, and Siddhartha will go on his way. Until then, however, let us be good friends. The merchant's attempts to convince Siddhartha that he was eating his, Kamaswami's, bread were also in vain. Siddhartha ate his own bread. Moreover, they all ate the bread of others, everybody's bread. Siddhartha was never concerned about Kamaswami's troubles, and Kamaswami had many troubles. If a transaction threatened to be unsuccessful, if a consignment of goods was lost, if a debtor appeared unable to pay, Kamaswami could never persuade his colleague that it served any purpose to utter troubled or angry words, to form wrinkles on the forehead and sleep badly. When Kamaswami once reminded him that he had learned everything from him, he replied, "Do not make such jokes. I have learned from you how much a basket of fish costs, and how much interest one can claim for lending money. But that is your knowledge. But I did not learn how to think from you, my dear Kamaswami. It would be better if you learned that from me." His heart was not indeed in business. It was useful in order to bring him money for Kamala, and it brought him more than he really needed. Moreover, Siddhartha's sympathy and curiosity lay only with people whose work, troubles, pleasures, and follies were more unknown and remote from him than the moon. Although he found it so easy to speak to everyone, to live with everyone, to learn from everyone, he was very conscious of the fact that there was something which separated him from them, and this was due to the fact that he had been a Shramana. He saw people living in a childish or animal-like way, which he both loved and despised. He saw them toiling, saw them suffer and grow gray about things that to him did not seem worth the price. For money, small pleasures, and trivial honors, he saw them scold and hurt each other. He saw them lament over pains at which the Shramana laughs, and suffer at deprivations which a Shramana does not feel. He accepted all that people brought to him. The merchant who brought him linen for sale was welcome. The debtor who sought a loan was welcome. The beggar who was welcome, who stayed an hour telling him the story of his poverty, and who was yet not as poor as any Shramana. He did not treat the rich foreign merchant differently from the servant who shaved him, and the peddlers, from whom he bought bananas and let himself be robbed of small coins. If Kamaswami came to him and told him his troubles or made him reproaches about a transaction, he listened curiously and attentively, was amazed at him, tried to understand him, conceded to him a little where it seemed necessary, and turned away from him to the next who wanted him. And many people came to him, many to trade with him, many to deceive him, many to listen to him, many to elicit his sympathy, many to listen to his advice. He gave advice. He sympathized. He gave presents. He allowed himself to be cheated a little, and he occupied his thoughts with all the game and the passion with which all men play it, as much as he had previously occupied his thoughts with the gods and Brahman. At times he heard within him a soft, gentle voice which reminded him quietly, complained quietly, so that he could hardly hear it, Then he suddenly saw clearly that he was leading a strange life, that he was doing many things that were only a game, that he was quite cheerful and sometimes experienced pleasure, but that real life was flowing past him and did not touch him. Like a player who plays with his ball, he played with his business, with the people around him, watched them, derived amusement from them, but with his heart, with his real nature, he was not there. His real self wandered elsewhere, far away, wandered on and on invisibly, and had nothing to do with his life. He was sometimes afraid of these thoughts, and wished that he could also share their childish daily affairs with intensity, truly to take part in them, to enjoy and live their lives instead of being there as an onlooker. He visited the beautiful Kamala regularly, learned the art of love, in which more than anything else giving and taking become one. He talked to her, learned from her, gave her advice, received advice. She understood him better than Govinda had once done. She was more like him. Once he said to her, "You are like me. You are different from other people. You are Kamala and no one else, and within you there is stillness and sanctuary to which you can retreat at any time and be yourself, just as I can. Few people have that capacity, and yet everyone could have it." "Not all people are clever," said Kamala. "It has nothing to do with that, Kamala," said Siddhartha. "Kamaswami is just as clever as I am, and yet he has no sanctuary. Others have it who are only children in understanding. Most people, Kamala, are like a falling leaf that drifts and turns in the air, flutters and falls to the ground. But a few others are like stars which travel one defined path. No wind reaches them. They have within themselves their guide and their path. Among all the wise men of whom I knew many, there was one who was perfect in this respect. I can never forget him. He is Gotama, the illustrious one, who preaches this gospel. Thousands of young men hear his teachings every day and follow his instructions every hour. But they are falling leaves. They have not the wisdom and guide within themselves." Kamala looked at him and smiled. "You are talking about him again," she said. "Again you have Shramana thoughts." Siddhartha was silent, and they played the game of love, one of the 30 or 40 different games which Kamala knew. Her body was as supple as a jaguar and a hunter's bow. Whoever learned about love from her learned many pleasures, many secrets. She played with Siddhartha for a long time, repulsed him, overwhelmed him, conquered him, rejoiced at her mastery until he was overcome and lay exhausted at her side. The courtesan bent over him and looked long at his face, into his eyes that had grown tired. "You are the best lover I have had," she said thoughtfully. "You are stronger than others, more supple, more willing." "You have learned my art well, Siddhartha. Some day, when I am older, I will have a child by you. And yet, my dear, you have remained a Shramana. You do not really love me. You love nobody. Is that not true?" "Maybe," said Siddhartha wearily. "I am like you. You cannot love either. Otherwise, how could you practice love as an art? Perhaps people like us cannot love. Ordinary people can. That is their secret." Samsara. For a long time, Siddhartha had lived the life of the world without belonging to it. His senses, which he had deadened during the ardent Shramana years, were again awakened. He had tasted riches, passion, and power, but for a long time he remained a Shramana in his heart,